You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Tough one for the Badgers tonight, 91-60 the final score, but there were some positive moments for the UW. Let's take a listen to some of tonight's highlights.
Now McCray has it to Porter with five. Porter, a pass into the front court. Myers in the corner, has some room, launches for three at the buzzer and hits it. Three-pointer at the buzzer to end the second quarter. Here's McCray working down low, missing the shot, fighting for the offensive rebound, and she'll lay it off the glass for two.
Couple of highlights there for the Badgers as they drop their seventh Big Ten game. And another one on the road upcoming for Wisconsin as they'll try to earn a season split with the Minnesota Gophers. This will be their fourth straight game, by the way, against a team either in the top 25 or receiving votes. Nebraska is receiving votes in the top 25. They're actually, if you look at it, they're the 26th best team in the AP top 25. And Minnesota comes in ranked number 24. In the country. Actually, I think the Gophers actually moved up in the latest rankings, but another top 25 team, that's the point here for Wisconsin. That one's coming up on Sunday as the Badgers and Gophers will meet with a 1:40 pregame and 2 p.m. tip time, just after 2 p.m. for the Badgers and the Gophers. Minnesota now number 23 in the latest AP poll, so they moved up one spot. All right, well, that's going to do it for me here from Pinnacle Bank Arena. I'd like to thank Dawson Brown for producing tonight's game in Jefferson City. For Dawson, I'm John Audius saying goodbye from Lincoln, Nebraska. Once again, that final score, Cornhuskers 91, Wisconsin 60. Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Women's Basketball.
What does it mean to be locally owned and operated? For Cenex, it means everything. It means that we know if you take your coffee to go or if you like to stay a while. It means we've helped little leagues get jerseys and local festivals get funding. It means we know what our communities need. So you'll always leave Cenex with a full tank, full of snacks, or full of smiles. Or all of the above. And that means the world to us. Cenex, powered locally.
The big game. Family. Friends. We know you count on Alliant Energy to deliver the safe, reliable energy you need, whether you're watching the game, cooking your famous burgers, or leaving a light on for loved ones. For us, it means going beyond the expected to make sure we're planning for the energy you need today and tomorrow. That way, you can keep your eye on the ball and focus on what's most important to you. Find out more at AlliantEnergy.com/poweringbeyond.
At U.S. Bank, when they say they're in it with you, they mean it. Not just for the good stuff, the grand openings and celebrations, although those are pretty great, but for all the hard work it took to get there, the fine-tuning of goals, the managing of cash and workflows and decision-making. They're in to help you through all of it. Because together they're proving day in and day out that there is nothing as powerful as the power of us. Visit usbank.com to get started today. Equal housing lender, member FDIC, copyright 2024 U.S. Bank.
Are you seeking a better career? Rail Transport offers truck drivers a variety of driving jobs earning top wages. No CDL? No problem. Get paid to get your CDL with Rail's on-the-job paid training program. We're also seeking top talent for driver and customer support positions. To see all the career opportunities at Rail and how you can take home more and be home more, visit rail.jobs. That's rail.jobs. Rail Transport is a proud sponsor of the Badgers.
Wisconsin women's basketball has been brought to you by Alliant Energy. Alliant Energy is powering beyond for you. And by UW Health Sports Medicine, treating the Badgers, treating you. The preceding has been a Learfield presentation of the Badger Sports Network.
Day. Hey, 248 and a half years. We'd gone without a dictator. Well, maybe tomorrow we can start over again. And for those 248 and a half years, we as free citizens have engaged in the wonderful experiment, now failed experiment, of self-governance. Government of, for, and by we the people. Now we've abdicated that to one Donald J. Trump. we have a dictator. And evidently today they're going to be 100, 200. We have no idea. You know, we may find out at some point the official count of edicts coming from up high, from the ivory tower, from our palace. And what's interesting to me is, I don't think we've made enough of that yet. What my email box has been filled with are Democrats angry at me. Evidently, I have upset some Democrats. Lots of emails from viewers recently and listeners taking precious time out of their lives to tell me that they're done with me because evidently I attack Democrats. And this is one of those things where you go, hey, Democrats haven't been great. Now, understand, Republicans have been horrible. And I understand that full-heartedly. And I talk about that quite often. They have been our enemy, the enemy of the working class. Every policy that they've moved forward, every bit of agenda that they've moved has been for the sole purpose of enriching the very wealthy, of giving corporate interests and the powerful more power, more control, and taking what little power and wealth the working class has and trickling it up. And look, we know the lie, the big lie of trickle-down economics was really masterful in how they spun it. We're going to give rich people money, okay? We're going to give them all of it. And when they get tired of it, when their pockets are full, when their great-great-great-grandchildren's pockets are full, then maybe we'll leave a crumb behind. And you, the unwashed masses, you, the working rabble, you can fight over those crumbs. And maybe if you're fortunate enough, you're lucky enough, we may allow you to pretend we're going to make you one of us. But we're going to keep feeding you stories of you know, people who, you know, like Elon Musk, who pulled himself up by the bootstraps. Never mind the fact that his parents owned an emerald mine in South Africa. Never mind that. Never mind they exploited thousands of African workers and pocketed the gains. Never mind that. Shh. But evidently, I have upset some Democrats by pointing out the fact that I didn't think Carter was a very good president. I thought his deregulation policies were terrible. They've harmed the working class. He was the first neoliberal president. It's true. I thought he was a great human being. I thought his head and his heart were trying to be in the right place. I've talked about Bill Clinton. Not a huge fan. NAFTA was terrible. A lot of the stuff that he moved on the neoliberal agenda, not thrilled with. Obama and his obsession to work. Oh, we're going to all work together and get half of what we need. Yeah, I got problems with that. And Biden, I thought Biden did well. I think Biden did everything we needed him to do, but sadly didn't have the messaging machine to hammer the accomplishments home. I think Biden had great material, just couldn't deliver the punchline consistently. Does this mean that I'm a bad Democrat? Maybe. Or it means that I want better Democrats. It means, and maybe it means that I'm hard on Democrats because I expect, no, wait, I demand better from them. I demand that they live up to the rhetoric that they spin to me. Oh, but Rick, it's this other, you know, there's always a reason. And yet, we continue to lose. Now, understand, as I said a moment ago, I know at my core, the GOP and Trump, they don't give a tinker's damn about you or me or any of the working class of this country. I know that. But I expect Democrats to be better. And I will hold them accountable. And if that is too far for some fragile ego to take, then it was nice knowing you. Thank you for tuning in. But if you want to make this country better, if you want to stand up and fight a Donald Trump or a Republican Party hell-bent on dominating the working class and stealing from our children, then steal up. Join up, get involved, and be a little less fragile when there's constructive, real criticism to be had. Maybe learn the lessons. And that's always been my point in this. I want better Democrats. It is the central purpose of starting this program. Because, look, I did live through the Carter years as a young child. I do remember the promises that didn't happen. And he had 61 senators. He had a vast majority in the House. Now you go, but Rick, you know, those were Southern Democrats. Point well taken. But you got to put a little elbow grease into it. You got to put a little push into it. You got to build popular support. You've got to engage in a way that rallies people. That's what I want from Democrats. I want them to have a message. It's always good to have one. I want them to build a machine to help get that message out. And I want to rally around a future, a vision for this country that, well, makes the working class prosperous again. FDR was the master at this. The fireside chats spoke to working people in their souls. He used what was the crisis, and he used it in a way to build a future. You know, I remember hearing stories from my grandparents saying, you know, this is what we heard. This is what we fought for. This is what we believed we were handing to our children and to our grandchildren. That's what Democrats should be. And yet I get people going, well, you know, Democrats, you know, they can't only, you know, kowtow to labor. Look what labor's doing now. You know, Sean Fain says he's willing to work with Donald Trump. Sean O'Brien's going to the inauguration. You know, every labor leader's playing this conciliatory tone that, you know, they wish and hope, you know, Trump well, and they, you know, they're ready to work together and all that. And you go, yeah, of course, because they have to. They have to fight for their members. Let me say that again. They have to fight for their members. And if that means working with Donald Trump on things that they agree with, you do that. You get out of Trump what you can. But in all of those things in Project 2025 that we spent the entire election talking about, I guarantee you every one of those labor leaders are going to be in lockstep fighting this administration when that happens. And it's going to happen. We're already seeing the CEO class tingly in the panties at the possibilities of what they're going to be able to do now that they control our government. Now that we're putting billionaires and CEOs into positions of power and leadership. They're talking about, you know, reinventing government in a way that, well, isn't about self-governance of we the people. Isn't a government of for and by we the people of this country, but just a handful. The billionaire class that we've created through 50 years of trickle-down mythology. 50 years of our labor being stolen from us and handed to our owners. And you go, oh, Rick, that's harsh. No, it's not. There have been studies after study, you know, done on this. The London School of Economics, you know, back several years ago came out and was very clear about the fact that because of the tax cuts, the wealth class has benefited wildly. In fact, they did a study. They looked at countries, you know, from 1980 until I think it was 2020. And what they found is that countries who pursued the tax cut model, you know, what the U.S. was doing, they grew a billionaire class. And guess what? Poverty went up. The myth of a middle class went away. And you began to separate. You had really rich people and everybody else. And in countries that didn't do that whole tax cut thing, what you saw is a more egalitarian society. There was much more broad shared wealth. Why? Because we don't want an Elon Musk. We don't want a Jeff Bezos. We don't want a Zuckerberg, or go down the list of our 700 plus billionaires who, because of the panic, the pandemic, pocketed like a couple of trillion extra dollars. You know, a couple of trillion extra dollars that were your dollars. So for me, this is where the moment of holding Democrats' feet to the fire is important. I want fighters. You've heard me say on this program before that a Democrat in the street fight will offer to hold your coat. I want somebody who's going to take that coat, throw it over someone's head, and go after them. I want somebody who's going to stand up. I want somebody who's going to get in there and ball up their little digits and fight. Are we seeing that right now? What we're seeing now is a period of appeasement. Is it going to work? I don't know. Everyone is on the Trump bandwagon trying to play nice so that they don't catch his ire. Is it smart policy? Probably. It's probably smart for right now because these next 6 months, our dictator is going to do what dictators do. He's going to try and silence the opposition. He's going to go after his political enemies and use the full force of the federal government to do that. And we had better pay attention. And we had better have some strong, steel-spined Democrats who are going to stand up and, well, fight back. When this stuff happens in Congress, we need people who are going to stand up and say no and not do what Democrats have done historically, which is, oh, we need to work together. We can negotiate. We can find a bipartisan solution, which goes like this. Republicans go, I need both your legs. Democrats go, no, I need my legs. No. Republicans go, no, I want them both. How about just one? Oh, okay, we'll take one. And then 6 months later, Republicans go, nah, we need the other one. How about just up to the knee? To where eventually Republicans get what they want and Democrats, under the guise of, you know, working together, we end up losing everything. Look where we are. I want people who are going to have a steel spine. I want Democrats who have a strong message. I want them to fight for the working class. I want them to make lives better. I want them, well, I want them to throw the coat on the ground and have my back. And if you think this Democratic Party has been that, I'm not there with you yet. I do want to hear the angry emails. By all means, rick@therickSmithshow.com. And if you're just going to write, I'm done with you, save it. I've heard it. I want to hear a real reason. Quick break, right back. When we come back, Phil Glover from the American Federation of Government Employees is going to be here to share some thoughts.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Yes, happy Dictator Day, January 20th, 2025, the first Dictator Day, as I've been saying, since, you know, July 4th, 1776. So we were able to hold on to this little thing called self-governance, you know, government of, for, and by we the people, only about 248 and a half years. And today, the day that we just hand that over, and look, everyone's waiting to see how many executive orders. Is it 100? Is it 200? How many edicts from upon the hill were we get from the Oval Office today? I'm here to share some thoughts on just how bad that could be, especially for our government employees. I've asked my good friend Phil Glover to come talk with us. Phil is District 3 National Vice President for the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE. Phil, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Rick.
So, I guess, what are we expecting? How many of the executive orders are we thinking are coming, and how many are pointed at you?
Well, he started out with about 100, he said, and then now it's up to 200 actions today. We are bracing for at least 7 to 10 that will affect directly the federal workforce. And then we'll have to determine, you know, what the federal courts might do with those things, or if we have to go through administrative processes first, like grievances and things like that. So that's what we're looking at.
And it seems, again, you go through the whole campaign, it really was about grievance. It really was about attacking federal workers. It was about attacking others. I think we're going to see firsthand, just how bad this. I think overreach is going to be so bad that even the Red Hat folks are going to go, whoa, this isn't quite what we wanted, because it's us.
Well, I could tell you we have members that voted for him, obviously, in every sector of life. You have your folks that support him, even after what he did the last time to the federal workforce. So this time they didn't believe that he would do a hiring freeze, for instance, although that seems to be one of his first acts today or later today might be to impose a hiring freeze on the federal government. And people just don't understand how that harms productivity, safety and security, getting things done for the military, all of these things that the government does that everyone, forgets about until
they need
until something doesn't get done. Yeah. until doesn't get done.
Or right? Until they need it, until it hits them personally. And this is where, we keep hearing that the government has this great office, though, of gold-plated door of waste, fraud, and abuse, and they keep pointing at little things here or there to keep people angry. When the real waste, fraud, and abuse is, well, you think about the massive, lucrative government contracts we've given, the world's greatest welfare queen, Elon Musk, the contracts that we hand out to these contractors, and all of the things that we've privatized over the years, and I argue. The hiring freeze that you've talked about that they want to do is more about privatizing our government functions than it is about getting anything done.
Oh, absolutely. Their whole, my understanding is he's looking at contracting a lot of the prison system out. You would think a fully government function is to, secure people who are, found guilty by their peers in the courts of law. But no, we're hearing, more about privatization of prisons again. We are, if you look at the military industrial complex, and that I guess now would include NASA, Mr. Musk is deep into those contracts, a lot of money. And I am still trying to figure out why he shot himself with his EV people by joining up with Mr. Trump. But who knows? He's a billionaire and has time and money to spend. So
not just a billionaire, a half a trillionaire. We're talking the kind of outweighed, outrageous wealth that I know the founding fathers would be rolling in their graves over. Because look, as I said, today is dictator day. Trump said day one, he's going to be a dictator. Even if he claims it's only for one, we'll see. But we haven't had one of those in 248 and a half years. And yet the weird thing is there are people who are like, we need to get some things done.
Yeah, I just think that, again, for instance, he's going to do an executive order to order all federal workers off telework and back to work. And the problem with that whole thing is they are at work. They've been working. We have Social Security people that are processing claims. We have Veterans Benefit Administration people that are processing veterans claims. Those people are all doing that. And they are doing some of that in the office and some of that in a work from home capacity, which makes them more productive. All of the studies are showing that there's more production over this period of time as far as getting these things done. And without coming in and learning anything or talking to anybody in the federal government, he's already made it in his head that he needs to order everyone off telework.
Yeah, but Phil,
we had telework before COVID.
Yeah, I get it. But here's the thing, Phil.
It wasn't as much.
Phil, we both know this isn't about productivity. We both know this isn't about getting the best product for consumers, for citizens. We both know that. This is about power and control. This has nothing to do with productivity.
Very true, but you would hope the American public would want productivity. You'd hope they want their checks getting to them when they're supposed to. All of the other things that are done. And it just, you sit here and shake your head as you hear him give these speeches and talk about some of the things he talks about. It really is disappointing.
Yeah. Now,
those of us that actually know what's going on in the government.
We talked an awful lot during the campaign about Project 2025. Trump himself said, not my plan. I have nothing to do with it. Yet we see, 28, 30 people who were the authors of that report now, seeking cabinet positions or in the administration. How much of Project 2025, the 940-odd page wet dream wish list of the conservative movement, do you think we'll be moving on day one?
I think he'll be moving on a majority of it as soon as he can get executive orders written. I do think the House and Senate, there are some things that they'll have to pass, which they're teeing up in reconciliation bills so that they don't have to deal with filibusters and, 60 vote margins in the Senate. So there's going to be a lot of stuff coming, and it's all coming out of that 2025. His budget director was an author of it. He now has today, I think I saw, maybe it was yesterday, he has rehired and re-put into the Domestic Policy Council, Mr. Shirk, I believe his name is, who drafted these things in his last administration to fire employees, to make it much more difficult to be a federal worker than what it needs to be. And so they just put him back in the Domestic Policy Council. So this is what he's going to do. And our members, especially the people that supported him, I think are going to be stunned how fast this is going to go.
Well, what do you say to the person like me who says, maybe you voted for this. This is what you want. You deserve what's coming your way.
There have been days as we've gotten closer and closer to today that I almost wish it upon people. I almost want them to get what he wants to give them. But all of us that, 50% of the country did not go with this person. They didn't vote for this guy. To me, at least 50% of the federal workforce doesn't deserve what's coming their way.
Right. No, I'm with you.
They just don't. And so we're going to, AFG's going to,
No, clearly you're going to do what you have to do.
Absolutely. Our member.
Absolutely. So last question I've got for you, because, this day forward, we know that the assaults are going to come fast and furious. And I think maybe we're going to start waking up to the reason that we didn't elect him 4 years ago because of the chaos, the spaghetti theory of all the you-know-what he's going to throw against the wall. Do you think that the country will remember why 4 years ago that they didn't vote for him? Or do you think that people are just so tired that they're just not going to be paying attention anymore and they're going to be able to just steamroll over virtually everything that they want to do because people are just worn out?
I do think that's a concern that people are going to be numb to it. I think the last time people did get to the point where they just didn't want to hear the chaos anymore and they voted him out. And I don't know when that tipping point will be this time, but I think it's going to come because some of the things that he's talking about, once he goes to implement them, I do think a lot of the American public is going to go, wait a minute, that's not what I wanted. Grocery prices and gas prices or whatever is what drove them to the polls this time. I don't think some of the other stuff that he and Mr. Musk and Ramaswamy have to give to us is really what they want. And so when they start to cut Medicare and they start to cut Medicaid and they start to chop into Social Security and those kind of things, I think the American public, a lot of times will wake up and say, okay, this is not what we wanted. I think veterans who start to see the Veterans Administration privatized in a big way, not piecemeal like has been happening, but in a large way, I think veterans like myself are going to say, whoa, wait a minute. That's not what we want. Ramaswamy talked about cutting $190 billion out of the healthcare system of the VA. Now I don't know where that money goes And I certainly don't know why it wouldn't go into VA healthcare for veterans. We have a lot of guys coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan, different places that deserve full treatment and certainly don't deserve to be nickel and dimed by this government.
We're going to see. We're going to see just how bad it gets. But, Phil, as always, I appreciate your time. Thanks. I look forward to having you back as we watch this train wreck develop. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it. And good luck to you.
Thanks so much. Phil Glover, District 3 National Vice President for AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. Are you ready for what's coming? You ready for the chaos? You ready to remember what those 4 years of Trump were like? Well, you don't have a choice. It's coming. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to Lake Air WLAK, Amory's home for Matt and Air on Air.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. For tonight, partly cloudy, bitter cold, a low of 18 below, wind chills to 35 below. Increasing clouds for tomorrow, a high of 8 above. Some flurries and snow showers tomorrow night. Breezy, rising temps to the upper 20s by Wednesday. It's 15 below right now.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Jack Smith's report. Maggie, prosecutors considered charging Trump with inciting insurrection, but didn't.
There's an old saying, if you shoot at the king, don't miss.
If it's someone who's really powerful or really rich, I gotta be absolutely certain I can prove every charge beyond a reasonable doubt. When it's people that don't have means, then it's I'll throw every conceivable charge at you.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
We're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So evidently, the reporting coming out that Vivek Ramaswamy, evidently not going to be Doge Boy. Evidently, the short-lived co-director, co-head, co-chief cook and bottle washer of the Department on Government Efficiency. Evidently, he's talking about running for governor. Could be end of the month, an announcement. First thing I thought of is, well, God help Ohio. and I got to think, look, Ramaswamy didn't want to play second fiddle to Elon Musk. I get that. Looking for something else to do. Let's find out what that could mean for Ohio, which is why I've asked my good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst Bob Ney to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So what do you think? I thought Doge Boy was going to have a long career. Him and Elon, they're going to get in there and they were going to slash and burn. They were going to save government. They were going to make it more efficient. They were going to slice it to the bone and privatize and profitize. I guess short-lived career there.
Well, there were a few factors in moving pieces as this has all come together, Rick. Number one, Vivek Ramaswamy was intending to be part of the Doge, you know, movement with Elon, and then that would have been his entree into, you know, the Congress and the, you know, the House, the Senate, and the White House. So I think that was a legitimate deal that he was trying to pursue. Now, a lot of people thought that, you know, maybe Jane Timken or Congressman Mike Kerry or a few others might be appointed to the U.S. Senate, because Vivek Ramaswamy was not interested in the U.S. Senate. So I want to make that clear. The Lieutenant Governor John Husted was most likely going to run for governor. So the appointment for Vance's seat would have been a couple of the people that I mentioned, but all of a sudden, Trump had basically given the nod for Vivek Ramaswamy to be United States Senator. He wanted him to be U.S. Senator. Yet you didn't see Vivek Ramaswamy say, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be U.S. Senator to, you know, take the seat that J.D. Vance had. As a result of that, Husted, our lieutenant governor, went down to Mar-a-Lago and then after that, DeWine made the appointment when Vance, of course, officially resigned. And our governor, Mike DeWine in Ohio, made the appointment of Husted as United States Senator. Immediately, Vivek Ramaswamy didn't make comments about, you know, he, you know, was upset or anything about the process. So I'm not sure why Trump threw his name out there except to put him in position to maybe do what he's going to do now, which is Ramaswamy's going to announce within next 2 weeks that he's going to run for governor of Ohio. So I don't think he intended to do that originally. He was probably going to follow Doge, but then the opportunity with the lieutenant governor stepping out, I can tell you right now, Ramaswamy cannot be beat in an Ohio primary. I mean, there's going to be Republicans that are going to go for other office holders if they run, but I can't imagine how he would be, you know, beaten in that primary.
Wow. So Governor Ramaswamy, is that what we're thinking?
Might be. I mean, it depends who the Democrats come up with, because Ohio is not a state that bounces back and forth. But remember something, it originally did at one point in time. It went for Obama. Now it's become I know, red state, but you never know in the political process what happens. I will tell you, the Democrat announced Democrat right now for governor. The Democrat Party's got to find another candidate, somebody to run against her. I'm sorry, but Amy Acton was head of the health department under the Republican governor, number one. That's going to cause her some heartburn within Democrats no matter what. And she was the health person under Mike DeWine, like I just said, the Republican governor, but she also resigned. And it was the COVID controversy. And, you know, history's not going to repeat itself in the governor's race for COVID. Yeah. Not now.
No, she's got way too much baggage there.
Exactly.
You know, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Ohio, since I left, has gone really kind of crazy. But here's the thing, and this is where I have hope. I think the next 2 years are going to be a nightmare. Eggs weren't a dollar a dozen today. I drove past the gas station, wasn't a buck a gallon either. And we were promised that. We were promised all these things are going to happen on day one. Haven't. So I got to think in the next 2 years, as the promises aren't met, as inflation goes up, because, well, what we're seeing right now is that, according to the Wall Street Journal, they're looking at the fact that Trump's policies that he stated is going to make inflation higher. So you've got top economists, you know, running models that say, you know, over the next 2 years, we're going to see, you know, inflation going up and up and up, you know, basically making people's lives worse, not better, making prices go up, not down. And I think that anger could sway elections, maybe even in a place like Ohio.
Well, I mean, it's up for grabs, I think, depending upon what does happen, because let's take a couple of the issues. First of all, immigration, which is something that the Biden administration just simply, you know, fell asleep on, period. Yeah. So immigration with Trump, and I don't know what's, you know, all going to happen, but that has to be, I'm not going to say solved, but it has to have the numbers drop significantly. That's one thing, you know, that has to happen out there. The second thing, which is the one I happen to personally like, and that's because it's old habits of when I was in Congress, but I like tariffs. The reason I like tariffs is because it forces China, I hope, to come to terms with us, because we gave away with the, you know, different legislation in the past, we gave away our rights, permanent trade status for China, and they laughed all the way to the bank. So in the long run, if that in a particular causes some inflation, I think in the long run, it helps us if we bring back the manufacturing base and good paying jobs, you know, for working Americans. That one can come through. And, you know, Biden did keep Trump's tariffs because Biden knew, he'd been around a long time, that one, you know, could potentially work and hasn't hurt us, you know, in the last 4 years. So that one, I think there's some hope because it's more of a card game with the Chinese. It's more of a poker game.
Yeah.
Now, the immigration, that's yet to be seen. So those are two factors that Trump has to be successful on. Now, the big one you mentioned, inflation. I don't know what's going to happen because, frankly, Trump and then Biden before him and the Congress, Democrats, Republicans, the $35, $37, $38 trillion clock is ticking and everybody's ignoring it. And that is an inflation factor. So if that deficit rises, which Trump added more to the deficit during his presidency than Biden did. So if that continues to happen, no matter what the policies are of Trump, for the most part, inflation's going to ramp up. It does, because of the process of trying to pay off the interest payments on the deficit, the debt, everything combined is a problem for us. And it is an inflation factor that nobody likes to talk about. You know, they like to talk about the other problems out there, the supply chains, you know, or the tariffs. So we'll see where that goes. Now, the other factor that's going to be a determining factor in inflation is going to be the policies that they create new. Are they going to do tax cuts? What does that do to the deficit, which could add to inflation? What will be the policies? But there's one thing for sure. Let's say Trump solves, when I say solve, for the most part, makes the immigration situation better. And let's say the tariffs semi-work. You still have the debt, the deficit, and you still have the policies of Trump, which if they don't work out to bring inflation down, then yes, midterm, anybody could have trouble.
Yeah.
Including Ramaswamy, anyone could have trouble.
You brought up, you know, immigration and solving that. Do you now see the Lankford bill as something possible? Because, you know, they had the votes. They could have passed James Lankford's bill and Trump put a stop to it. Is it now, because Trump could put his name on it, is it now something palatable?
Well, I think it has to be changed, because the problem with the bill originally was it has a number system. If on X day, you know, 3,000 come across the border, everything kicks in. But if it drops to 1,500, everything goes backwards. They have this numbers game in that, and I think that's got to be changed. So the base bill could be alive, but they're going to have to make, I think, and they probably would try to make some significant changes in it, so that you're not relying upon a daily number system of how people decide to come across the border or not that day.
Now, you brought up talking about immigration. I saw a story here recently that the border czar, this Tom Homan, he's evidently rethinking the raids that they had planned in Chicago. Evidently, there was a leak. He said that they're going to look into the leak. They're going to find the leak. You know, all the stuff that you hear people say when something gets leaked. And I got a sneaking suspicion they leaked it just to see what kind of reaction. But I'm curious if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, you can hear the conversation. Homan says, leak the information. Just make sure we're not attached to it. I mean, people do this. You know, these administrations do it. I love when these stories come out that the president told so-and-so and hung the phone up. Yeah, okay, fine. You know, then none of the president's policies are ever followed or adhered to. But, you know, you've got the leak out there. Leaks are done for several reasons. Test the waters. Maybe the Trump administration is trying to test the waters. If you know, they're going to raid Chicago and all of a sudden everybody gives a standing ovation, well, maybe they'll raid Chicago. You know, who knows? I think if it was a leak, Rick, to try to see where they really want to go with this, and you know, maybe they're rethinking their policy, because Trump's actually said that they're kind of rethinking how they're going to approach this. Yes, I think it was a leak to see reactions and to see where they really want to go with this thing.
Or my other thought is they're just going to keep leaking this stuff. We're going to go to Chicago, so people start leaving Chicago. There's a part of me that goes, a lot of this is just, it's just, you know, smoke and mirrors. It's just a dog and pony show.
Well, I mean, it could be, but people will catch on to that, you know, now that they have come out and said, well, Trump's rethinking the policy about what they're going to do and how, if they're going to go to Chicago. So after a while, everybody gets smart. Even people here, not legally, would say, okay, you know, they're doing this, we're going to stay put. There's a lot to be developed on this too. And if you do a raid and you've got somebody that's a dreamer, that's a different category. I mean, there's a lot left to this. To me, they will try to go in and pick what I'd call the low-hanging fruit, which is to, you know, for example, look at the 13,000 people in prison. Are some of them in for minor offenses? There, you know, Can 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people be let out and deported immediately, put on planes and sent back to their home countries? Maybe they could do that. So I don't know. I don't know where they'll start, but we'll see. I mean, they can't just sit and do nothing because they have said they will do something.
Right. What's interesting to me, though, is and I've been spending a lot of time these last 19 weeks in a hospital. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you haven't spent a lot of time in the hospital, there are a lot of immigrant workers in those hospitals. And I've had a lot of conversations with people who are here from, you know, varying, you know, places across the globe. And they're all concerned. They're concerned for their safety. They're concerned for their children. And these are people who are here in a legal capacity. These are people who, quote unquote, followed the right system. But these folks are, they're scared.
Well, I mean, I think there is also an over paranoia. Now, if you're a dreamer, probably they have fear because they're in this really strange category of having been born here, but they were not born to legal parents, but they were born here. And, you know, we have birthright clauses still here. You know, it's still part of us. But again, they might have a legal struggle. So I can see that. I had a friend of mine who called me and she's American and she gave birth and her husband was foreign and she's worried and the kids are 40 years old. I'm like, stop it. You know, just stop it. You're American. They were born here. So, you know, there's some of that that's out there. But I think some people would have a fear, especially the dreamers who were born here, which I don't care the status of their parents, that until something changes, they're going to be viewed as legal Americans.
I'm glad you're confident about that. I, you know, didn't Trump say executive order gonna undo that constitutional thing and we're gonna get rid of that?
He can't. Yeah. I mean, it's a constitution.
I get
it's
that.
A constitutional issue.
I get it, man. But you know what? The unanimous Supreme Court said we're gonna ban TikTok, and Trump said I don't think so. So I don't know. I'm in a weird spot on this one. Last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, we're seeing the first round of hostages released as the Gaza mm-hmm. ceasefire takes hold. And I got to tell you, you know, the timing of this seems curious to me. I lived through the era of the Iran hostage situation. I remember when Reagan put his hand on the Bible and all the hostages were sent into the streets. I remember the imagery of, you know, the tough guy who, you know, everyone feared. But over the years, we've heard some very interesting stories around that. I just keep coming back to it just yeah. seems like an interesting timing for this.
Well, it is. Look, I lived in Iran in 1978. I was there when the revolution started. I left in the summer of 78. In fact, the last director of the Iran Anjuman Society, it was called, Catherine Kuhb, was the boss of the system that I had worked for, you know, when we were teaching over there to the Iranians. And so it was, you know, something I followed deeply. And there was no question in my mind that, you know, the Iranians, in fact, they were more dramatic than the Israelis. They released the Iranians in the Israeli situation I met. The Iranians released the hostages as Reagan's limo was going down to the Capitol. And there was a fear at that time in the Iranian hierarchy, I think, that Reagan was going to take his hand off the Bible and say, well, where's that button? You know, that was the rumor in Iran that it was going to be full scale. We're going to get you. And so they did respond. There's no question about it. They responded to the fact there was going to be a new president. I believe in this situation, we've had three hostages released right before the inauguration of Trump. And 33 more or 31 more would be, I guess, are scheduled. And then there's a process. Then there's a phase two. Now, the other day, when the media said to President Biden about Trump being part of this, he turned and said, is that a joke? But his own national security advisor, John Kirby, I watched a video where he said Trump and Biden, this was a joint effort. So Biden saying one thing, you know, Kirby saying another. But I have no doubt in my mind, no doubt, having followed the Mideast most of my adult life and when I was in Congress, no question that Netanyahu, who struggled because he had Gavir, his minister, who just resigned, by the way, yesterday, or 2 days ago over this ceasefire. He's unhappy, but Netanyahu had to do something with this because Israelis were becoming very angry over it. But there's no question in my mind that Netanyahu was reacting to Donald Trump. And I think we've got to give this one to Trump, because for the entire year, Netanyahu sat there. He didn't care what Biden said. Biden would, you know, beat his fist down, cuss him out, et cetera, et cetera. And that whole scenario just played out. And it had an effect on Biden, frankly, in the election. And I think it's something that the Israelis were probably going to come to terms with anyway. But I think Hamas and Israel, both, Hamas included, read the tea leaves and did not want to start confronting all of this after Donald Trump became president. So I really believe that, that Trump was a major influence on the fact that he was becoming president, was a major reason for both sides to kind of get something going. That, I do believe that.
So what would be the reason for that? Because, you know, look, I've got friends on the left who say, you know, Netanyahu held this out long enough to get Trump elected, that that was part of the calculus. Do you see any of that?
There is no question that Netanyahu damaged the reelection efforts. Now, I want to make this clear before everybody loses their mind and you get a thousand, you know, texts and emails on this. Netanyahu has the interests of the Israeli hostages. Israel has the interests of the Israeli hostages. I'm not saying they don't, but Netanyahu, I believe, is pro-Trump more than he is pro-Biden. And if Netanyahu had the ability to do things to particularly not make Biden look in the best favorable light, I believe that would happen. So I've got to agree with anybody that's told you that, you know, maybe not to the day prior to the inaugural that Netanyahu was going to say, yeah, now we've got a deal. But I think that over the process of the last year, there's no question that Netanyahu did things. There was announcements, for example, by Biden that they were close to part of the process. And all of a sudden, Netanyahu would backtrack on things. So I think definitely, if you ask Netanyahu and he was honest, who he wanted in the White House, he was going to say Trump.
Yeah, if he's honest, absolutely.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
Absolutely,
Bob. As always, I appreciate the time. Good stuff, my friend.
Thank you, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Send the angry emails. I want to hear it, because look, this is one of those screwy situations. Someone gave Trump credit for something, but I want to hear it. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1986. That was the first time Dr. Martin Luther King Day was observed as a national holiday. A powerful voice for civil rights, Dr. King was assassinated in 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee, while standing on the second floor of the Lorraine Motel. He was in Memphis standing up for the rights of black garbage collectors. Dr. King gave his life supporting those fighting for union recognition. Throughout his work as a civil rights leader, Dr. King spoke powerfully of the importance of unions. Addressing a group of Teamsters in 1967, he said, "Union recognition meant the real beginning. Union meant strength, and recognition meant the employer's acknowledgement of that strength." Perhaps his most stirring reflections on the labor movement came in a speech he delivered to the AFL-CIO in Springfield, Illinois in 1965. King said, "The two most dynamic movements that reshaped the nation during the past three decades are the labor and civil rights movements. Our combined strength is potentially enormous. We have not used a fraction of it for our own good or for the need of society as a whole. If we make the war on poverty a total war, if we seek higher standards for all workers for an enriched life, we have the ability to accomplish it, and our nation has the ability to provide it. if our two movements unite. Their social pioneering initiative, 30 years from now, people will look back on this day and honor those who had the vision to see the full possibilities of modern society and the courage to fight for their realization. On that day, the Brotherhood of Man, undergirded by economic security, will be a thrilling and creative reality.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I could feel the collective heartbeat of a bunch of people as Bob said, no, we're going to give Donald Trump credit for this. This is not a good way to get credit for something. Understand, Netanyahu stuck it to Biden in the worst way. Because ultimately, he thinks he's going to get whatever he wants out of Trump. That's not a good thing for us, I don't think. And it reminded me of 1980, because I remember, you know, the messaging, the narrative that came out of all of that, that, you know, Ronald Reagan was so tough and, you know, he was going to, you know, immediately he was going to push the button and they were going to start bombing and all this. And then you find out later that there was a lot of back and forth, you know, between, you know, back channel stuff, because after all, remember, H.W. Bush was head of the CIA at one point. In fact, the CIA building's named after him. And you start to hear these stories of, well, it's kind of coordinated. They kind of wanted to get rid of the hostages, you know, well before that day, but needed the visual, needed the myth, the legend. And what we're seeing is the same kind of playbook over and over. We're going to see a lot of this stuff. What's frustrating is the more simplistic it is, the more we buy. And I've had people who have said, well, you know, they were so afraid that they let him go because I'm not sure what we're going to do. Because here's the weird thing. My red hat friends say that he's so tough and that he's going to take on all these things. And he would, you know, I don't know what. But on the other hand, it's he didn't get us in any wars and he's not going to, you know, he's not going to get involved in all that stuff. And you go, how do you hold both thoughts in your head at the same time? Not how it works. And I do see at some point there being an end to what's going on in Ukraine. And of course, they're going to go, oh, look, he brought peace to Ukraine. And what he's going to end up doing is giving a large chunk of Ukraine to Russia. Russia's going to win. And because the Ukrainians aren't going to have anyone to help them. And that's going to be part of Trump's legacy internationally. Here at home, he's going to be the great peacemaker. He's going to be the one who, because the world's afraid of him, because he's the tough guy who, you know, won't hold his inauguration outside. It's cold. It's cold out. Don't want to stand outside. Am I the only one who looks at some of these folks and goes, you know, paper tough guys? We're in for a very long 4 years. It's going to be an interesting 4 years. What I'm hoping to do over this period of time is not pay attention to the circus. Not spend all my time looking at the clown car, but looking at what the CEO class is doing behind the scenes. Looking for those stories and those things that are going to affect our lives for decades to come. Because understand, rich people don't spend money unless they think they're going to get it back. And then some. The oligarchy in this country has lined up behind Trump in a way that has never happened before. At least not in my lifetime. And what they know and what they believe and what they're expecting is more for them. More power, more control, more wealth. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. They fear Trump. They fear that, you know, he's going to use government against him. But they also know, you know, big enough bribes, sweeten the pot a little bit. They might get themselves a cabinet position to oversee the industry in which they're regulated by. And then what do they get to do? Whatever they want. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick@therickSmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Thanks so much for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickssmithshow.com.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Richard Cantu. The return of President Trump. Donald Trump back in the White House after Monday's swearing in on the Russia-Ukraine war. He said Zelensky wants to negotiate an end to the hostilities. Putin, not so sure.
He's telling me he wants to make a deal. I mean, he wants to make a deal. Zelensky wants to make a deal. I don't know if Putin does. He might not. I don't know. And he should make a deal. I think he's destroying Russia.
We saw him do some executive actions. Getting stuff through Congress is going to be much, much more difficult given the narrow majority. He's got the majority, but it's oh so narrow.
ABC's Jonathan Carl. Now former Vice President Harris and husband are in Southern California surveying fire damage. Their L.A. home survived the Palisades fire.
We are blessed. Our home is standing. We were under a mandatory evacuation, and it was lifted, and just a couple days ago, we're able to go back.
This is ABC News.